Hey guys, what's up? It is week 343. I'm off by 100. That's not too bad, I guess. But let's hop right into the reviews for you. The first one up is Horrors of the Black Museum, and this is from 1959. This is a VCI release. This one I had never actually seen. It's a 59. Like I said, it's a Herman Cohen production, and he kind of was famous for making these kind of like teenage-oriented horror films. I was a teenage Frankenstein. I was a teenage werewolf. So essentially the plot here is there's these kind of mysterious murders going on. Kind of really crazy implements are used, so everybody's trying to figure out how this is going, who's behind it. And Michael Goff is basically this like super popular horror, like true crime writer, which is really awesome. Obviously true crime's always been popular, it's very popular right now, so they kind of are asking him questions. He gets directly involved with the police kind of case, but there's just a little bit more to Michael Goff than you would expect. I mean it's kind of obvious. He plays a prick really well. I mean, if you ever watched him in the old Hammer movies, he pops up in Horror of Dracula. Of course, he went on to play Alfred in the Batman movies, by the first two by Tim Burton, and probably think that whole series, the first four on that, the two after Joel Schumacher ones as well. But he's also in stuff like, what is it, Berserker, or Berserk with, who's in that one? Is that Joan Collins? But yeah, he's in a bunch of movies, and he plays this kind of uptight, like, true crime writer. He's a prick, obsessed with the murders and everything like that. So he's kind of going back and forth with the detectives. And it turns out that there's sort of like Jekyll Hyde kind of like thing going on as well. I don't want to spoil everything, but they kind of reveal about halfway through what's going on. For the most part, I like the idea of a true crime writer being involved with the police investigation and being questioned about it, and the weird implements, and the twist I think was really good as well. Now in the special features, they point out stuff like, who is this? They have an archival commentary by the writer-producer Herman Cohen, a new 2023 commentary by Robert Kelly, noted film historian and artist. So they have this hilarious original Hypno Vista opening, which directly ties in with the plot of the movie. But there's my favorite thing is there's an archival phone interview. Where am I looking for? A tribute to producer Herman Cohen. And I like this a lot because it's basically his best friend who learned a lot from Herman Cohen and kind of taught him all these things about the film industry. And we talk about a lot of his movies that he made, Teenage Frankenstein, Teenage Werewolf, and he has pretty much the same outline in all his films, right? Basically, evil older man takes a young teenager under his wing, manipulates him, and that's kind of the structure of all his films. This one actually was this, they go into the history too and how successful this one was and kind of how it helped, I think, AIP get more expensive pictures. So this was a nice one to see. It was kind of a nice piece of horror history that I had not seen. I always assumed it was a wax museum movie because Black Museum, Horrors of Black Museum, but no, that's not necessarily the case at all. I enjoyed it. Pretty interesting watch. Horrors of the Black Museum, check it out. As far as I could tell, it looked pretty solid. It's hard to tell with a lot of these low budget, you know, 50s and 60s horror movies, how good the 4K and Blu-ray's qualities are sometimes, especially if I'm not super familiar with the film in general. So yeah, check it out if it sounds like it's up your alley. All right, the next one up is from Mondo Macabro from 1969. This is a Spanish film, Shadow of Death. This one I had not heard too much about. It's in the giallo kind of style, the kind of thriller, crimmy, whatever you want to call it, style. So essentially, this one's pretty strange. So we have these pair of twin brothers played by the same actor, one of which who was successful, one of which has a bad leg, was in war, kind of wasted all his inheritance, while the other one opened a business. And the successful one is married to this kind of this woman in a loveless marriage. He loves her. She doesn't love him. Obviously, she has eyes for the brother. So you see where this is going. This mysterious kind of trench-coated man with a scar on his face shows up straight out of like a film noir or something like that, or a giallo, if you will. He shows up and he wants to blackmail the wife of this rich guy, telling her that he knows all these secrets and everything like that. But of course, the twin brother and her have their own ideas, and they're basically playing these kind of gaslighting games and trying to make the character think that they're crazy. So they implement this guy as well. So it's definitely that kind of ordeal where you have the gothic kind of mystery of trying to drive someone insane to get inheritance and control of their estates, all these kind of things playing into it. But of course, there's going to be a lot of twists. And when you have two actors playing the same character, the same actor playing two different characters, twin brothers, you're going to have a lot of play with that. You know what I mean? It's not going to be so clear cut. There's going to be twists. It's going to get blurry. As far as keeping your intention, I thought it did a pretty good job. Also, as far as, you know, not confusing you, because a lot of giallo can get a little sloppy. They can get a little kind of like iffy on the plot, and you're like, that doesn't make too much sense. This one does have one of these most ridiculous endings. You're like, how could I have predicted that? That's almost science fiction. But at the same time, while watching it, you're never lost. You're never super confused by anything. You kind of always think in the back of your head, is this actually who I'm watching? But at the same time, you're never completely thrown for a loop where you're completely lost, where you don't know where they got from point A to point B. Overall, this is a pretty solid thriller. I enjoyed it myself. I liked the twist at the end. I thought it was pretty dark, pretty entertaining. The special features are cool too, because one on here is the one that I liked is Interview with Angel Sala, director of Stygius Film Festival, and this is good. This is a longer version, the long kind of interview, because he starts talking about this director's work, and he mentions Paul Naschy and Jess Franco and all these kind of guys. I don't remember if he mentions Jose Larraz, but all these Spanish directors that have kind of some weight to them, and he mentions this guy has like 3 or 4 films. He starts talking about him, and he's like, you know, and it was kind of interesting to learn, because this is a director I'm not super familiar with. You know, Shadow of Death is definitely the first one I've seen by him. I think it's worthwhile. I think it's interesting. And if you like thrillers and twists and all that kind of stuff, then check it out, especially from this time period. It's got a lot of nice little touches and everything, gaslighting. It definitely feels like a little even older than it is, just by the general plot and everything like that. But 1969, so it's early. It's before Bird with the Crystal Plumage, not before, you know, Blood and Black Lace. But I don't think it shares much DNA with those. It has, of course, you know, the mystery and stuff like that and the gothic stuff, but it's not what people would traditionally call giallo. So yeah, Shadow of Death. Okay, this next one is absolutely ridiculous. So I was like, okay, so it's on Thanksgiving break and stuff, and I had some downtime. What am I going to watch? What am I going to choose to watch to treat myself? I finished my movies that I kind of was obligated to watch a couple, so I was like, I'm going to treat myself to Blades. That's right, the 1989 Jaws kind of parody deal about a killer lawnmower on a golf course. That is right. Vinegar Syndrome put this trauma distributed movie out on Blu-ray. It looks really good. Yeah, so this one I had never actually watched Blades. I had heard about it before because it's absolutely ridiculous, right? Killer lawnmower, golf course, and it reminds me of the movie that came out this year, Caddy Hack, which was fun, about killer gophers on the golf course. Golf course, kind of an underutilized kind of deal here. So it does remind me also of the trauma distributed movie Bloodhook, which is absolutely ridiculous here, about a killer killing people during a fishing derby. But so basically what we have here is this one plays it pretty straight. All the actors play it straight. We have kind of like a pro hired to kind of start this kind of big, you know, tournament deal at the golf course. It's a huge deal, right? It can't be shut down for anything, right? Think Jaws, right? You know, it's 4th of July weekend. It's exact same plot, literally verbatim. There's moments in this movie that are direct spoofs of Jaws. The director, the producer, all of them knew they were in on it. But the thing that makes Blades work, instead of being like so many movies now where it's like there's this guy running around like farting every time he talks, and everybody's just over the top to the point of trying to be bad because they think it's funny, the audience a lot of times doesn't, and that never worked for me. So as well made as some of those movies can be or entertaining, I just never really care for the purposely bad on purpose. Hell, I don't even like Tactical Killer Tomatoes. So this one plays it straight. The actors are playing it straight. It's absolutely ridiculous. But kind of the three main characters are kind of a groundskeeper who's bald, who's seen the machines before do this. You know, he's your typical Quint kind of character. And then also we have the two kind of here, the leads, the pro who's getting hired there, and then kind of like the basically the headmaster golf teacher or everything. She's there. And these two kind of have an unfriendly, like unlikely friendship that almost blossoms into a love. And all these three basically have to take out the killer lawnmower. And of course, it's a little longer than it should be. There's not as many kills as you would expect, honestly. This movie does not have that many kills. There's a couple gory kills. Most of the characters that do get killed are nobodies, or they don't have much character development, or they just find somebody to get killed in the vein of Jaws, right? Because, I mean, there's not many characters in Jaws that are known who they are. They even do the part where the lady walks up and slaps Roy Scheider. They do that here, which is really funny, in a stupid-ass scene about an old man who got killed. Anyways, I enjoyed this. It's better than you would really expect, because it's played straight. Is it a masterpiece? No. Do you expect a movie called Blades to be a masterpiece? No. Do you expect it to be this good? Probably not either. So, I mean, it's above my expectations here. As far as the special features are concerned, we have a commentary track with director Thomas R. Rondella and writer William our pace for Warnering, making of documentary featuring interviews to the cast and crew. And I really like this because we got a lot of the producers and the, everything like that. And the one guy who said he went to like this college and he was pitching these ideas and he was like, well, girl school screamers. And then he was like, Blades about a killer lawnmower. And he said, I looked in there and there's two guys that looked at each other and they were like, they were digging the Blades idea. And that just was a lot of fun because this guy just knew exactly what he was doing. And they were in on it and they knew what they were doing and they made it right. I mean, this is about as good as you can make something like this. So it's entertaining. Looks really good too on Blu-ray. Check out Blades if it sounds like it's up your alley. Okay, the next up is the 4K edition of The Mist, of course, directed by Frank Darabont in, what, 2007, starring Thomas Jane, Laurie Holden, who else was in there? A bunch of people. Geez, I can't believe I forgot Ollie Week's name in here. William Sanderson's in here. I'm going to drive me crazy. Toby Jones, I think, is his name. Yeah, that's right. So anyways, The Mist. It's based off the novella by Stephen King from The Skeleton Crew, which was a great, great little novella that he wrote. And it's essentially about this kind of mist that kind of goes into this small town, it's a group of people that are trapped in a grocery store while there's creatures out in the mist that are trying to pick them off. Of course, some inner turmoil happens and they are at each other's throats and everything like that. So yeah, this one it's just way better than it has any right to be for a Stephen King adaptation. To be honest, there's a lot of Stephen King adaptations that don't really hold their own. Frank Darabont's made three, and a lot of people would argue that he's made the three best, The Shawshank Redemption, The Green Mile, and The Mist. I don't know if I'd go that far, but I think that he did a damn good job with this, and I don't think I've ever seen the entire Green Mile, but The Shawshank Redemption as well, obviously. But The Mist, this is his kind of his first horror kind of one. I know he worked on The Blob from 88, didn't direct, but worked on it, and script, I think. Great job. Worked on The Walking Dead first season, which I will say the first season is pretty solid stuff, and then it gets pretty shitty pretty quick after that. But rewatching this, I saw this when it came out in theaters, and I remember really enjoying it. I thought some of the CGI was shoddy a little bit here and there, but it never really affected my viewing because it was such a captivating movie. So like I said, I kind of explained the plot here, but there's a lot of small details that I really love in here. You know, there's obviously shout-outs in the very beginning to, you know, Stephen King, The Thing, all sorts of things like that. So you're kind of setting up this kind of, you know, even a Lovecraft kind of element too with The Thing. And this is probably Stephen King's most Lovecraftian, I think, story, if I'm thinking correctly. These kind of things coming out of a portal, a different dimension possibly, and they're creatures in the mist. Nobody really knows what they are. You can't even really see them that well, that unknown, that unfathomable. What could possibly be in the mist. I'm going to spoil this. There's some really stuff that matches up with the novella that I think is really cool, but they do take their own changes and they do some things like that, and they hint at it in the novella, but they never actually go through with it. Sorry, my camera did that. They never go through with it in the novella. It is a little different than that, to be honest. So in the novella, they kind of, the ending is a little bit more open-ended. The possibility may be a little darker for the entire world, but nothing's quite as dark as this ending for this character here in Thomas Jane. The actor who plays Mrs. Carmody, she's excellent in this. She starts this kind of religious movement within the grocery store, and she starts to kind of manipulate it. And there's small characters in the background you see throughout, and they kind of had these character arcs, whether it's the biker who kind of dies early on, but he still has these great little moments, or the neighbor who has the dispute with the tree and all that kind of stuff. He has his great moments. I know it's not... I don't know if it's natural or man-made, but it's definitely not supernatural, all that kind of stuff. And then even like William Sanderson, his character starts in the very beginning. He does something where he makes a huge mistake and he regrets it, and he tries to redeem himself, and he completely crumbles, and then he completely gets brainwashed. It's really, really entertaining to watch him, and it took a good character actor to kind of bring that character to life. Of course, Jeffrey DeMunn's in here. He's got that great line, "There's something in the mist," of course. Pops up at Christmas Evil in every Frank Darabont movie, including The Walking Dead television series. But the CGI, some of it's not great. A lot of the times it works pretty well. I didn't even watch the black and white version on the 4K. The 4K looked really good, and I forgot to watch the black and white, but they're both in here, both got their own disc and everything. I really wish I would have watched the black and white. Next time I watch it, I will. I always tell myself that, and I always forget, because I hear the CGI looks much better in black and white. And the movie, Darabont wanted to make it in black and white, but they wouldn't let him. So anyways, this one still holds up. It's still scary. There's still great acting. There's still great moments. The CGI doesn't really bother me that bad. I mean, some some of it looks kind of whatever, but the movie's so captivating, and the acting is really well done, and the characters are really solid. All in all, I like it. It's very Stephen King in the characters and everything like that. I think he captures it well, but you know, sometimes Stephen King can lose himself in his stories. I mean, everybody does. You write 10 million stories, you know, not every one is going to be perfect, of course, right? And he's wrote some of the most popular horror stories of all time. The Mist, I think, is a great novella. I think Skeleton Crew as a whole, remember loving that short story anthology. I read it over 15 years ago, probably now. I'm probably close to 18 years old when I read that, so I'm close to 20. But anyways, I remember really liking it, and The Mist was a standout. I love the Lovecraftian aspect of the creatures, the unknown. But it's just also, again, it goes to the classic Night of the Living Dead. The people are the biggest enemy, right? They're at each other's throats. But there's a lot of cool monsters in here, and just the idea, it leaves you room to think. It leaves you room to think what's out there. Not everything is shown, and you hear giant monsters and see glimpses of them. Just really cool stuff. So The Mist, great characters, great story, just overall amazingly entertaining on 4K. Looks good. All right, let's hop into those 1981 movies.
Woe be unto him who opens one of the seven gateways to hell, because through that gateway, evil will invade the world.
That'll live on, and no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago. In this little town, when the 14th comes round, there's a silence and fear in the air. Remember the morn that the legend was born, all the shock and the horror was there. For the legend, they say, on a Valentine's Day is a curse that'll live on. And no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago. And no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago.
All right, the first up is a rewatch, and I wanted to rewatch this because it got a new, brand new 4K a little bit ago. Brand new, a little bit ago. Doesn't make any sense. But a new 4K from Severin, and I watched my old 88 films import, but I definitely wanted to pop in the 4K of Nightmare, or Nightmares in a Damaged Brain, or Blood Splash, whichever you want to call it. Yeah, this one made the Video Nasties list, and this disc sure doesn't let you forget that. So, it's directed by Romano, what is the director's name? Romano Scavolini, who also did Dog Tags, which Vinegar Syndrome Archive put out. Good movie, very fun movie. Joe Rubin actually recommended it on the kind of the nesting Black Friday talk. So, Nightmares in a Damaged Brain. Okay, so this one is kind of in line with Maniac and Halloween. So the first half of the movie, we kind of have this character named George Tatum, who's going through these experimental medical kind of issues. He obviously has some real messed up childhood trauma that we get glimpses at through the entire film. And his first night out on his own, he goes to New York City and he sees all these kind of like sleazy places and everything like that. And he escapes. And on his way to Florida is where we find out he's going. He murders this woman. And after that, it's kind of a whole entire murder spree kind of deal until he runs in with this small child that he has a connection with. There's going to be spoilers here. The other half of the movie kind of follows some of the doctors trying to find him. That's a very small part of it. But a huge chunk of it is this family drama. A mother, a single mother with three kids while she's trying to date. And CJ, who's this little kid who is, I think it's CJ, he's just absolutely terrible when it comes to pranks and things like that. And just, he's just not really a very well-behaved kid. And you like feel for this woman. Like they're screaming. It feels like a Lifetime movie a lot. Just this woman struggling with these kids. But there's this constant like presence in the background of George Tatum walking around in a trench coat and all these kind of things. So it's going to climax into kind of like a babysitter watching the kids. It's a very much slasher-esque ending, and the kid's going to have to stand up to him kind of a la Friday 13th Part 4. So it's definitely in that slasher mold in the second half. The first half definitely feels more in line with a psychological horror film like Maniac, which also has slasher bits. Some people consider that a slasher. So I definitely would consider this a slasher in a lot of ways and not. Of course, it landed on the Video Nasties list, and the producer actually gotten some deep shit for this. The guy who distributed it in UK, not producer, but he distributed this in UK, and he was distributing a lot of these porno films and Video Nasties. He actually did time. And there's actually there's three discs set here. And the third disc is actually generally just the documentary about this guy. What is it? Damaged the Very British Obscenity of David Hamilton Grant. It talks about his entire life story, all these kind of things like that. And eventually what happened to the guy in terms of Video Nasties and all that stuff. As far as special features on this disc, boy, we got a lot. It's in 4K. It looks good. I mean, this movie is pretty low budget, pretty trashy. Not super low budget, but it's well made. It's well done. So it looks pretty solid. Looks better than the Blu-rays and DVDs I had previously, for sure. We have an audio commentary with star Bard Stafford, and he's since passed, I'm pretty sure. And special effects assistant Clave Hall, moderated by Lee Christian and David Dakota. That's actually a really good commentary. It's old from the Code Red DVD. They kind of cover a lot of stuff. They do a really good job here. And then we have audio commentary with producer William Paul. Then disc two, we have Kill Thy Father and Thy Mother, interview with director Romano Scavolini. Dreaming Up a Nightmare, cast and crew interviews. That's cool. Nightmare of a Nightmare, interview with erroneously credited special effects director Tom Savini. It's 7 minutes. Michael Felsher kind of talks to him. It's funny. You know, Tom Savini can barely remember the movie, but he definitely takes credit for the kid looking at himself in the mirror, which is like the poignant moment of the scene and the film, and it keeps cutting back to it. So it's like, I don't know about that. The Stuff That Nightmares Are Made Of, interview with makeup artist Robin Stevens. A Nightmare on Many Streets, locations tour with Rube Morgue writer Michael Gingold. Open Mat Peep Show sequence for you perverts out there. Deleted scenes and still gallery. And yeah, that's three discs here. Yeah, so that's very awesome. And we also have The Violent Nature of the Selling of a Nightmare booklet by Mondo Digital's Nathaniel Thompson. Region free on the Blu-ray, and of course 4K is as well. So Nightmares in a Damaged Brain. It's never looked better and never will look better. There's never going to be a better addition to this movie. So if you're a fan, grab it. I'm a big fan myself. And, you know, it's one that was always obscure. It was always hard to find. So it was one that I always gravitated towards. And now we have these deluxe 4Ks that I just had to talk about. Okay, the next one from 1981 is an MVD Classics here, and this is directed by Ellen I'm not going to say that director's name, but also Jess Franco. I've seen so many Jess Franco movies lately, and this is from 1981. This is kind of your standard woman in prison, kind of Nazi-esque, like warden kind of movie. Let me read the back here, because there's not much going on in this movie that I can explain to you, and I don't mean that as just me being stupid or like whatever, because sometimes I'm like, I'm lost here. There's just nothing here. I'm sorry. So, one of the most notorious women in prison epics, the Jess Franco production stars Lena Romay, as Maria Del Guerrera, who's sentenced to life after killing her father, who had attempted to assault her. While behind bars, Maria encounters a sadistic female warden and hatches an escape plan involving the seduction of a male nurse. Monica Swin and Paul Muir also star in this salacious tale. Paul Muir is in here, and he plays a doctor. He's kind of a weirdo, and he's always worried about getting in trouble. So we have this governor, basically the subplot where the governor or this politician doesn't want anybody to find out how shittily run this prison is, but a lot of the prisoners don't know that he's in on it, so they're trying to get to him to write him a note and let him know how corrupt everything is. And of course, there's an evil female warden, and that's basically the plot of the film. At the same time, there's a guard who's kind of playing both sides, and there's a sleazy doctor, and that's it. And the governor sleeps with women. So basically, between those moments, all these women are getting raped by these guards, by these doctors, all these things like that. There's lots of sex, and every time there's a new character, it's like odds. They're like, "How'd you get in here?" And then they'll have a flashback. Some of these flashbacks, I'm pretty sure, are from previous Jess Franco movies, because there's this scene where you guys remember that slow motion Jess Franco playing, like, and he's like, "Oh, doing the slow motion." I was like, "I seen this scene before," because I laughed at it hysterically, because I've seen my man Jess do that before. There's no way he did that twice, two different times. So I'm sure they lifted that from another Jess Franco movie and just threw it in this one, which is hilarious, but also, I get it, you know. This has got to rank really low for Jess Franco movies, and I'm a Franco fan. This is not one of my favorite Franco. This is above the SOV, but that I watched, but this Vampire Junction, I think, but it's not much higher than that. I'm just not a fan of it. It's kind of basic, kind of boring. The end, of course, there's, like, I guess a slight twist, you could say, because there's some rebels coming into here. It's kind of bottom of the barrel women in prison movie. There's a lot of nudity, there's a lot of sex, there's a lot of rapey stuff, but there's not much of a plot that's worth mentioning. It looks okay. It doesn't look great. It's a low budget, really kind of crummy looking movie. It's a Eurocine. So, you know, Yuri Cini's really sleazy, really trashy, and you know what you're kind of getting. Jailhouse warden, Jailhouse wardress, it's not really my favorite Jess Franco movie. I'm not a big fan of this movie at all. It's just really kind of crummy. But if you're looking there for some sleaze, it has that in bundles. Okay, the next up is Female Teacher in Rope Hell. Female Teacher Rope Hell, and it's a Katsu erotic film, of course. Japanese, one of the rare Japanese ones, and I would put this in vain, maybe something Daydream, similar to that, which is Japanese, but Daydream is more artistic and absurd. This one is well made. It is short. I wouldn't say it's sweet. It's definitely not sweet, but it is short. Female Teacher Rope Hell. So what we have here is we have this woman. She's a good teacher. Everybody likes her. She has a student that loves her to death, and she essentially is kind of about to get married. So do we have that subplot too, which happens a lot in these movies. They always make it more tragic, right? So essentially they always have these moments where, like, you'll have this, like, sweet teacher, and they set her up that she's going to get married or something like that. And then something brutal happens. And of course the husband wants nothing to do with her after that, because she's shamed and she's all that kind of shit. That's like just all these Japanese movies. So what happens is one day there's this homeless guy trying to rape one of the students out there, and she breaks it up and stops it. And this homeless guy is just like a beast. So she saves her, but this homeless guy takes it out on her, and the student runs to find help. But the homeless guy kind of drags her in there, ties her up, and there's another kind of teacher there that witnesses it, and the student gets him, and the guy's like, "No, we can't go in there now. The guy might hurt her." So they witness this rape. He watches it, and is like, obviously he had some ulterior motives there. So what happens is she's raped. She's devastated, and one day they kind of keep it a secret, but this guy, this teacher, fellow teacher who witnessed the rape, is driving her to work, and she's allowed to stop at the house, and he locks her in the basement, and he's going to keep her as a slave. He's completely obsessed with her. Therefore starts kind of this whole kind of this sexual torture, right, where he's kind of trying to break her in to make her a slave. It's kind of like, what was that really crabby Star of David, Hunting Beautiful Girls, that element that this guy is like a whole torture dungeon in his basement. That one's more serial killer fucked up than this. This is still really twisted. We're talking 20 minutes into this hour and 10 minute movie, and this poor girl's got an enema. I was like, oh shit, water power over here. So there's an enema. So get your pervert card out big time for Female Teacher Rope Hell. So yeah, there's all sorts of rape and sadistic stuff here. And this girl just fights, this teacher's fighting for her best. You know, she doesn't want anything. So it gets complicated when the schoolgirl comes looking for her and she gets involved. But she doesn't exactly have the same mentality or same repulsion when it comes to the sexual torture, right? Of course it is. And it ends on a downbeat, dark ending. This is more horror than a lot of the other Japanese ones I think I watched this year. And I think it is horrifying. It's a Katsu, so there's a lot of these kind of really highly sexual, rapey movies. Big time. That's pretty much all they are, for the most part. And even if they're comedy, action, horror, they all have these rape elements in them at the time. It's just kind of the movies they were making. Overall, I think the movie's is actually pretty good for what it is. I mean, this is one of the better Nakatsu movies I've seen. It looks good too. You can find HD prints of it everywhere. So, and I don't know if this one got released on the Impulse line. I'm not too sure. I do have that entire line, so I probably should have double checked on there. And there's so many movies with similar titles. There's, you know, Female Beautician and Rope Hell, and there's so many of these bondage rope kind of torture porn weird Japanese movies from the 70s and 80s. So it's really hard to gravitate. This one's made in 81, of course, but yeah, overall, for what it is, it's a really solid, you know, kind of Nakatsu erotic film. It's really disturbing too on some of the stuff they're doing to her. I was just like, I can't believe they're doing that. A lot of butt stuff, which I didn't expect to see in this movie, although it's not a complete new thing for the Japanese Nakatsu erotic films, but this much I think it kind of was. The next one from 1981 is Atrapados, aka Trapped, and I believe this one has a kind of a strange thing element about it, that it was like a Puerto Rican one made by an English-speaking guy, but it's in Spanish. This movie's strange. So, do you remember that movie We Are the Flesh that came out probably like almost 10 years ago, probably at this point, where we have that idea, these like group of three people kind of trapped in this kind of this weird place, and they start to have these weird fantasies, and the entire world changes. This is kind of like a precursor to that, less sexual-driven, although it is there. So what happens is, in the very beginning, we kind of witness this kind of ghetto, and we have this kind of fat guy wandering through, this slobby guy, and everybody's making fun of him, saying, well, who's sleeping with your wife tonight, all these kind of things. And we have like essentially what happens is, we kind of cut to this kind of plumber that shows up to this really nice apartment, this basement apartment of this rich woman who's a psychic, and she's like, he doesn't like rich people, and she has all these ideas about her, and she's like, hey, well, I'm gonna get going, if you mind fixing this. Before she can get out of the building, it all crumbles in, and they're trapped underneath in this kind of structure. And over a long period of time, they start to think that maybe the world ended, which is a common thing in 81, right? Early Warning, all these kind of movies happen like that. And it also reminds me of that Dutch film that I watched a little bit ago. I can never remember anything, with Paul Freeman in it, on the island, and they think that possibly the end of the world has happened. So they start hitting these ideas. The end of the world was a big thing in 81. People kept thinking about it and talking about it in all these movies. So they start to kind of create their own world. And what happens is, it turns into this weird fantasy, esoteric, philosophical thing, which is not the easiest thing to follow. It's not the easiest thing to grasp. It's not the easiest thing to watch either, because the quality is terrible. It's on YouTube, and it's just really kind of grainy and shitty looking, and it's just not a remastered copy. So it gets really weird and really bizarre, and it forms this strange love story, and everybody starts to, you know, register who they are. Overall, I don't know if I even like it. I don't think it's bad. I just don't. Can't give this a hearty recommend. I guess in certain points it is interesting, and it gets to like astronomical kind of thing here, astrology and stuff like that. So it's like, it gets really weird and out there and strange. And there is a really grotesque scene of a birth that I was just like, geez, man, that happens a couple times. There's that one from Yarshi the Evil Giant, which has that really nasty one moment scene in there, and the rest of the movie is not too nasty, but it happens. Like, we just get these crazy scenes out of nowhere from 81. But that one is a pretty gnarly scene, and it's just kind of a bizarre film. I can't give it a wholehearted recommend, because you know what, it's a little too bizarre to grasp on first view. I'd like some context. I got a little bit, but not much. And it is also not the easiest film to follow, so if you're not in a great mood while watching it, it might not work for you. It didn't work too well for me, but I don't think it's bad either. But that is Trapped, so check it out. It's on YouTube if it sounds like it's up your alley. Okay, the next one up, somebody picked a Patreon pick, and it was my boy Dan the cameraman. He said, watch any Jamie Gillis movie you haven't seen. So I picked the 1983 Vinegar Syndrome Blu-ray of Corruption, starring Jamie Gillis, of course, directed by Roger Walkins, who would do Last House on Dead End Street a few years, probably 10 years before this, which is a cult horror movie, which is really good. And on this disc, if you know where to find it, as a bonus remastered, yeah, if you can find it. If you need to know, let me know, I'll tell you. Anyways, Corruption. So Roger Walkins, I did watch Shadows of the Mind as well, which is kind of this weird psychological kind of horror slasher he made in 1980. It's not great, but it's interesting. Last House on Dead End Street is really popular in like the Cinema Wasteland group, and it is a really strong horror film, really unique, really ahead of its time. But anyways, Corruption here. I was watching this, and it was kind of interesting. And I don't know really where to grasp or what I think of this, you know? So I'm not the foremost expert on pornographic films from the 70s and 80s. No way, you know. So while watching this, I was like, oh, this does have a lot of elements of actually just being a movie, and it has a weird foreboding energy about it. The score is great. The score is really good. Almost sounds very Carpenter-esque. I wouldn't be surprised if they lifted some of the score from Carpenter or something like that. It just sounded too familiar. So the score was excellent. The lighting was really good. The acting was solid. So what happens is Jamie Gillis kind of shows up to this place, and his brother is there, and he takes him into this underground world of all these different sexual things. And of course, it seems like a gauntlet. At one point, we see this guy go through the entire thing where he has to, like, he can't touch this woman, and then he gets a blowjob, and then he actually has sex. There's a lot of, like, fellatio and stuff like that in here, more so than actual sex. But there is sex here as well. And I was reading Letterboxd reviews, and people are like, Roger Watkins loved making movies. He hated pornos, making pornos, so he just, like, made all the sex scenes, like, he made them all, like, angry and stuff like that. So, like, the lighting is good, and it's interesting, and it is saying something, but I can never really grasp on what it was saying or what it was doing. Gillis, you know, I've seen him pop up in a lot of horror movies, like, isn't he in Demented, and he's in, of course, To All Good Night, and he's in a couple more, too, Night of the Zombies, so he had a little run of horror movies in the early 80s, and he's good in this. I mean, he's a solid actor, obviously, he's here to fuck, and he does his job, but for the most part, this really isn't my thing. I didn't love this movie, I didn't get sucked into it, I didn't see, like, that much of a horror thing about it, but I guess I would have to rewatch it. As far as the back says here, some men crave powers, others success, but no man is able to resist temptation. Williams, Jamie Gillis, owes a debt he may not be able to repay. His girlfriend's sister, Felicia, is a beautiful innocent thrust into a world of carnal vengeance. His mistress provides comfort but may not be able to save his fate. His employee tries to help but cannot resist his sinister desires. And his brother holds the final shocking surprise in this web of erotic deceit. Directed by Roger Watkins, Corruption is a dark tale of the frailty and hypocrisy of morality. Expertly photographed by Larry Ravine and featuring a stellar supporting cast of Timothy Clark, Samantha Fox, and Tish Ambrose. Vinegar Syndrome presents the acclaimed erotic masterpiece newly restored on Blu-ray for the first time. We have Through the Lens, interview with Larry Ravine, original theatrical trailer. Yeah, so anyways, it's interesting, and porn fans should love it. It's got a lot of good reviews. Don't take my word on it. Check it out yourself. It was interesting. It's just not something that I think I will revisit unless I have some more context to it. All right, questions, comments, concerns, all that jazz. Film Wolf 4078. Hey, Dave. Love me some Sterling Hayden. He was built for noir. Naked Alibi and The Asphalt Jungle, along with The Killing, are some classics. He was Spielberg's first choice to be Quint in Jaws, and he passed on due to tax problems. As much as I love the guy, I'm not sure he would have delivered Quint's monologue about the sinking of the USS Indianapolis as well as Robert Shaw, but hey, you never know. Yeah, Troy Howarth mentions that, and he also talks about Oliver Reed being possibly Quint in The Venom. In 1981 discussion, which stars Sterling Hayden and Oliver Reed, Troy Howarth goes into detail about, you know, Spielberg wanting Sterling Hayden and Oliver Reed for the role of Quint. So Ken Coakley, I did a Tremors marathon last year. I played them on a projector and felt like being in a movie theater while being in a hospital bed. The theater I worked at had the original, so I saw that theatrically. Fred Ward was an underrated actor who did a lot of great movies in the 80s. In 1983, he did two of my favorite films of the year. He played Gus Grimson in The Right Stuff and with Dennis Quaid, Ed Harris, and Lance Henderson. He also co-starred in the film Uncommon Valor with Gene Hackman as a burnout Vietnam vet who goes back to rescue POWs. The film also starred Reb Brown from Strike Commando and Captain America, as well as Tim Thomerson from Tranchers, as well as young Patrick Swayze. No, also don't forget Tex Randall Cobb. I remember that movie. And that movie's fun. It's good. It has a Blu-ray. I haven't watched it in years. And then we have Back to Tremors 2. It was just as much of a nail biter as the first one. I actually liked them all. On the topic of Beastman films in the Philippines, another one that I loved is Beast of the Yellow Knight. Yeah, starring John Ashley. That's pretty good. I covered that on here. I also am a fan of the films from Hemisphere Pictures, such as Blood Drinkers, Beast of Blood, Curse of the Vampires, and Mad Doctor of Blood Island. I can't remember which one of those I watched. So I liked The Killing because the cast was incredible. Sterling Hayden was a great actor. He was as great as the corrupt cop, Captain McCloskey. And one of those last films was King of Gypsies, starring Eric Roberts in the film debut. Hayden was also offered the role of Quentin Jaws, but he was a tax exile who would have all his wages garnished by the U.S. government. Tipsy Bones. A new setting is cool. Hope you get better fast. Appreciate the reviews. No problem. Explosive action. I am completely there with you on bringing back the 90-minute movie. 90-minute movie! Eddie Daniels. Dave, I hope you feel better soon. I appreciate you and your updates. Yeah, I do feel better, actually. Finally. Movie Junkie Reviews, 84. There's The Bat People, 74. Has a nice ballet theme song, too. Ballad, sorry. Doug Duggar, a senior, get better soon. A cosmic Curgency. Did you see Thanksgiving? No, I want to, though. Mike B, feel better. Good on you for powering through the reviews anyways. MJ, thank you. MJ, hope everything gets better. Thank you. Nick Mua from Belgium. Hope you're feeling better. We take our health for granted, but when it's not 100% enough doom and gloom, Long Arm of the Law looks like a very interesting franchise. My mother lived and worked in China for years, and back home she would often be called upon to act as translator for victims of gang trafficking. Thanks for bringing this series to my attention. Crazy. You like both Italian and Chinese cinema, but would you want to visit the countries themselves? Of course, why not? I'd be leery about China right now, just because a lot of the stuff with, I don't know, I would be much likely more to visit Italy right now, but I would not be opposed to visiting China one day. Why do you think people in small towns are always portrayed stupid, incestuous, and bigoted in horror movies? I think that a lot of times people just punch down and they think they just assume because they don't live in LA and New York, they're dummies. It's not always that way, I guess, but it's an easy target, I think, and people are afraid. It's a xenophobia. They're afraid of what they don't know, so they're afraid of small towns. They're afraid of, you know, different places and all things. Same reason people go in different countries in movies and get something bad happen to them. Would you say that the new Hellraiser box set is better than the old Scarlet box? I have not watched the new ones. I would review them if I did. I'm going to assume that they are, especially the outline of the box is better. It's more sturdy, unlike the old Hellraiser box is really kind of easy to destroy on accident. Many thanks for keeping us informed and entertaining during your illness. You're a class X, sir. No problem. Thank you. Adams, all the best to you, Dave. Thank you. Necropsy, hope your health improves. Wishing you well. Thank you. Stephen Hyde, wishing you to feel better. Thank you. Katum, feel better. Thanks for trudging through COVID to keep us in the know. No problem. COVID ain't nothing. I'm just kidding. I'll probably die in 2 weeks. But yeah, let's get in the update. It's a fairly decent sized one. So yeah. All right, let's get in this update. First up is Chupa, and this was during the Makeflix sale. This is a Tempe movie that was never previously released. It was on sale, good price. Never seen Chupa. They released it, I think, a couple years back, so I'm interested to finally check this one out. Tom Hoover directed it. Tom Hoover was a regular in Tempe movies. He's in Ozone. He's in Polymorph. Next up is The Alien Dead from Makeflix. So I remember enjoying this one somewhat when I watched it for 1980, Fred Olen Ray movie. Didn't have the Blu-ray. Now I do. Signed by Fred Olen Ray. Pretty awesome. Yeah, I think it also has brain leeches on there too, which is really cool. So yeah, good price on this during the sale. Alien Dead. Next up, of course, is The Freaks, the Tom Browning Sideshow Shocker set. It's got Freaks, what is it, The Unknown and The Mystic in there. Couldn't pass this up. This is the only title I grabbed for Criterion. Had to have it, you know, very cool stuff. Freaks is a classic. Then we have Tiger Cage here, which has all three Tiger Cage movies in Scream Factory release. I don't know if I've ever seen these. These look like fun, though. So Tiger Cage 1, 2, and 3. Why not? And then next up, we have the Jackie Chan Collection, Volume 1, 1976 to 1982. Very cool. So what's in here is, let me see, The Killer Meteors, Shaolin Wooden Men, To Kill with Intrigue, Snake and Crane, Arts of Shaolin, Dragon Fist, Battle Creek Brawl, and Dragon Lord. So yeah, that's right. Gotta love Jackie Chan. Some of these I'm not familiar with at all. Most of them, I don't think any of them, maybe. And then we have the Sonny Chiba Collection, Volume 2. Gotta love Sonny Chiba, badass Japanese action kind of star. What we have in here is The Defense Power of Aikido, 13 Steps of Maki, Karate Warriors, The Great Akinama Yakuza War, Karate for Life, Golgo 13 Assassin, and The Okinawa War of 10 Years. So this is Volume 2. I do have one. Very cool. And then we have coming up here, Shaw Brothers Classics Volume 1 from Scream Factory. Couldn't pass these up on sale. The Flying Dagger, The Golden Sword, The Invincible Fist, Dragon Swamp, The Sword of Swords, Killer Dart, The Jade Raska, The Bells of Death, The Thundering Sword, The Golden Shallow, and The Assassin. 13 movies. Or is it 11? It's 11 of these movies. Very cool. And then next up, we have, of course, the Shaw Brothers Classic Volume 2. There's 3 and 4 out already, so I'm behind already. So The Flying Guillotine, the Dragon Missile, The Bride from Hell, Heroes 2, Man of Iron, The Water Margin, The Delightful Forest, The Devil's Mirror, The Crimson Charm, The Shadow Whip, Lady of Steel, and Brothers 5. That's right. So what do you have here? Yeah, 12 on this set. So very cool stuff here. I went through those really quick. So what do you have here? You have 11, 12, 11, and then 12. So I'm looking forward to Volume 3 and 4 as well. So yeah, let's get back to the video. All right, guys, thank you very much for watching. And as always, have a good one. Me.